The Evening Chorus, a novel, written by Helen Humphreys and read by Morag Sims.
The dark swallows will return and again hang their nests on your balcony and strike your window with their wings. But those that slowed their flight to see your beauty, and those that learnt your name and mine, those won't return. Gustavo Adolfo Becker. 1940. Chapter 1. Red Start. James Hunter falls through morning. He swings from his parachute harness as the plane drops below him, the broken shell of the bomber sinking into the channel fog. The water is as jarring as solid earth and shockingly cold.
"Here, I'm over here,"
yells Roberts, the pilot of the Wellington. James fumbles to unclip himself from the parachute, then swims towards the pilot's voice and the shadow of the rubber dinghy bobbing in the swell. His bomber jacket and life vest allow only a stuttering breaststroke, and when he flips over on his back to rest for a moment, James notices that the vest has been ripped open above his heart. In the scramble from the cockpit, the canvas must have caught on a piece of sheared fuselage and torn. He touches the edges of the incision gingerly, as though it were his own flesh that had been sliced open, and the white fluff inside the life preserver lifts into the air, a few strands of the kapok floss drifting slowly upwards, small brown seeds swinging from the fibres. The shushing of the waves is suddenly interrupted by the whine of an engine. James Hunter takes a deep breath, blows it out under the floss, and watches as the tiny parachutes rise up into the fog and disappear. There's a moment when he's hopeful that it's a British ship, but after James blinks in the bright glare of the searchlight, he sees the shine of a black boot resting on the gunwale, and above that a gloved hand holding a pistol.
"Here,"
yells the soldier at the bow of the boat to the soldiers in the stern.
"Es gibt einen hier."
The engine cuts out immediately, and the soldier with the pistol leans over the gunwale. He grins at his captive, floating in the early morning chop, and says, clearly and in English,
"For you, the war is over."
The communal shower in the delousing building reminds James of boarding school. He places his kit neatly in the cardboard box with his name on it, then walks into the showers cupping his genitals, with the same protective modesty he displayed when he was 12 and forced to take swimming lessons in the brackish pond behind the school library. The hot blast of water is a relief after the cold of the sea. His newly and hastily shaven head stings when the shower water hits it. What started out as his 6-man bomber crew has multiplied at the delousing facility into 100 or so men, all of whom share the indignity of being captured within the same 24-hour period. Under the statutes of the Geneva Conventions, prisoners of war are allowed to wear their own uniforms. When the box with James's clothes is returned to him, his uniform is warm and smells like almonds.
"Cyanide,"
says the soldier next to him when he sees James sniffing his jacket like a dog.
"They think it kills the lice and stops the typhus."
"The Jerrys are more afraid of the louse than they are of us,"
mutters a man farther down the bench. But the louse will torment all of them in the prison camp. It will be worse than the boredom, the filth, and the food. The small insect, only the size of a sesame seed, will live in the clothing of the men, crawling onto their bodies to feed and then returning to the clothing to rest. In James's bunkhouse, the frantic slapping and jerky movements of a prisoner trying to kill the lice, while they're sucking his blood, became known as dancing the jig. Once, James wakes up to the sounds of a man crying and sees Stephen sitting at the table in the centre of the room. He's naked, his back covered in red sores from louse bites.
"I can't do it,"
he says when James climbs down from his bunk.
"I can't put it back on."